You are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A Radiant Creator isn't making a living, they are living. Michael Rechtenwald is a professor of liberal studies at New York University and former Marxist who, after being attacked on Twitter for expressing his anti-PC views, converted from a leftist to libertarianism, even though he still remains in the liberal world of academia. His new memoir, Springtime for Snowflakes, Social Justice and Its Postmodern Parentage, details the obscurity of postmodern theory to explain what spawned the contemporary social justice movement. Proponents of contemporary social justice will find much to hate and opponents much to love in this uncompromising and often humorous indictment. Dr. Rechtenwald, welcome to the Radiant Creators podcast. I think one of our first questions would be, can you tell us more about postmodern theory?
Postmodern theory is really what I'm talking about, not all of postmodernism, but postmodern theory, which is a set of propositions and schools of thought that fall under a common umbrella but are varied. There are a number of prongs to it. There's deconstruction, there's post-structuralism, which deconstruction is really a part of, there's post-colonialism, there's queer theory, there's a whole panoply of theoretical propositions and positions and sort of schools of thinking. And all of them are, they're not really self-consistent, but they're all relativistic, subjectivistic, idealistic, and anti-empirical. They don't like empirical reality very much. And I've shown that the postmodern theoretical roots of that social justice, this movement now that really isn't any, has nothing to do with justice at all. It's a radically leftist, postmodern based movement. I show how it its theories came out of, its ideas rather, came out of postmodern theory. You know, for example, in the transgenderism, with the idea that your gender has nothing to do with your biology, that it's completely about beliefs rather than anything else, and the language you use to term yourself, whatever you are. This is all very postmodern, that language constructs reality. That's a theory of deconstruction. The idea that language is what reality is made of is a very post-structuralist, postmodernist, deconstructivist idea. And all of these ideas, from the idea that one has their own truth, for example, this is a very social justice-oriented idea that comes from postmodernism, the idea that each person has, there is no objective reality, there's no objective truth. Everybody has their own truth and nobody else can possibly know it, especially subordinated people. I've shown how all this comes out of Marxism and post-structuralism and, you know, just postmodern theory in general. Postmodern theory is just best understood as an anti-establishment, anti-order, anti-rationality, anti-enlightenment set of ideas that came after the fall of the failure of the 1968 student rebellion in France. And after that rebellion failed, a number of theorists tried to explain why, in effect, and postmodern theory was born of that. They complained of things like master narratives or, you know, all-encompassing theories or mythos for explaining reality, social reality in general, as mistakes, as totalitarian in themselves. So it was actually a rejection of Marxism, but it's anti-capitalist as well. So it's the child of Marxism, but it's a disfigured child. It's a mutation from the left, really. It's a leftist mutation. And it's been adopted even on some side, even in some quarters by some parts of the right, but not most. Mostly it's a leftist orientation still.
Aside from the roots in postmodernism, what other factors have spawned this seemingly sudden onset of social justice?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, you could say that the Obama administration had a lot to do with it, because it sort of favored this identity politics, identity politics and postmodern theory really favored identity politics too, because it showed that it thought that the working class was not the real agent of history. So you could say the identity politics that was favored and fostered through the Obama years has a lot to do with it. I think the 2008 financial crisis left a lot of these people gasping for air and not knowing what to do. So they started attacking individuals for their identities rather than institutions, which they felt are out of their control, out of their purview. So it's a weird mutation of politics that, instead of trying to overturn systems and so forth, they attack localized and individual entities, particularly people who they seem to think are responsible for, like, the social structure as it is. So white, straight males, cis-hetero males are the biggest enemy. And of course, others who are putatively on the top of this hierarchy that they envision. I think the Obama administration has a lot to do with it.
What about education? It seems like a lot of these kids, is basic civics still being taught in high schools? It seems that ignorance of American government and history seems to have become normalized, sometimes even encouraged.
Yes, it's what they're teaching is strictly victim history. They don't teach anything in terms of, like, for example, the enshrined principles of the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights are basically not taught. All they're teaching is that certain people were slaves and there were other victims in history, women and African Americans and others, and they don't teach anything but victim history. And so everything is taught as a narrative of victimology. And the education system is completely ensconced with social justice values based on the education of these teachers who come out of universities taught in education departments, which is a very big rat's nest of social justice ideology. And I shouldn't put it in such negative terms, but it is. I mean, it's a rat's nest in the sense that this is a very, I mean, I think the book points out, and I think I make it clear, that it's a vile development, because it's all about hatred, resentment, upending the social order, flipping the hierarchy. They're not egalitarians. They're not interested in equality. They're interested in upending the hierarchy and exacting revenge on those they deem to be or have been the dominant. So the university system is the main culprit, but so social justice was gestated on the university. Then it moved out into the internet for a while during the Obama administration and Gamergate and all that. You sort of alluded to Gamergate. And then it came back into the university with a vengeance. And it's just taken over everything. It's gotten into all the policies. It's gotten into these mechanisms, like these bias hotlines, and it's gotten into the vocabulary, such that people are required to use pronouns that are made up to refer to fictitious genders that don't exist. Basically, but they have no empirical reality. They have a reality in the minds of those who believe in them, but they don't have any verification status. There's no way to know they exist other than people asserting that they exist. Things like this. So, yes.
And that always seems like quite the mind control game there, where it always takes an authoritarian presence. It always takes force in these situations to either connive people to believe things that are obviously untrue, and then mm-hmm. also to force others to have to agree with that. And then ultimately mm-hmm. you get into the editing of speech, you get into censorship on the internet, where anybody who has any common sense, any intelligence at all, knows that certain things are untrue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, but yet right. they fear to state them.
That's right. And it has been the case that we're what I call philosophical idealism or social idealism. That is where ideas are deemed real and are imposed upon, and beliefs are imposed upon reality rather than found there. There's always the requirement that force has to be used to make those beliefs, to enforce those beliefs. And so this has happened in the Soviet Union, it happened in communist China, and it's happening here in a soft sense. You know, we're not sending people to the gulag yet. We're not shooting them in the back of the head yet. But at this point, there's still force being used in the sense that there's policies being dictated, and there's, you know, hopefully not laws quite yet, but there are some laws. For example, in New York, if you misgender somebody pronoun-wise, you could get fined $250,000. If you refuse to use gender pronouns, you could lose your job. So, yes, people are being forced to adopt these notions and these beliefs and this set of language. Language is a real key of controlling reality and controlling people. If you can change the vocabulary and the language that is required to be used, you go a long way in changing the social reality that people are adapting to.
Okay, well, along with that, along with what you just said, I'm going to pass it over to... Okay. Well, I guess another question I have along those lines is, are schools, I should say, why are seemingly educated people not aware of the historical scope of socialism, fascism, or communism? I guess just giving them kind of putting a blanket term over all those. What causes so many of them to... so many students and then so many, I guess, alumni, truly, since we're focusing on colleges, what causes so many of them to admire tyrants such as Stalin, Marx, or even like one that always gets me because you see him on a lot of t-shirts these days is right. Che Guevara. I mean, right. That's just, it really is having no historical knowledge. It actually has always greatly disturbed me when I see, you know, usually youngsters wearing a Che Guevara right. T-shirt. I'm like, do you have any idea who this guy was? I mean, right. Even if you were a socialist, this guy was a monster.
Yes, it's because the left has controlled history. They have controlled education so much that, you know, when I went to look for, you know, sources, you know, for example, of the communist of the Cultural Revolution in communist China, when I went to dig into academic sources for the history and its connection to France, which there are connections, I couldn't find anything. It's because the left has buried this stuff. The left has been in charge of education, and as such, the academic left has buried the crimes of their leftist ancestors in Stalinist in communist China, in Stalinism, although there are a few books come out, you know, like the Black Book of Communism, which goes into a great deal of the history, but of course it's been denounced by most leftists as being malarkey, when in fact everything in there is very well sourced. I'm a historian myself, and you know, when you refer to documentary evidence, and every claim is backed up by documentary evidence in that book, which shows that there were 94 million people killed in the name of communism. And that's far more, you know, I'm not excusing by any means Nazi Germany, but that's far more than were killed by the Nazis. Far more. Well over four or five times. So, it's because of the left controlling education and not allowing differing views or criticism even from within. They'll crush leftist critics, they'll crush rightist critics, they'll crush any critics. And, you know, they're writing the history, so they're whitewashing the leftist totalitarian crimes out of the picture. You know, Che Guevara killed homosexuals regularly. I mean, that was the way of treating homosexuals in Cuba, was just to kill them. Allen Ginsberg, who was one of my mentors when I was younger, he pointed this out to the Cuban regime when he was there. And similarly in Czechoslovakia when he was there, they shipped him out of the country. He was a leftist, you know, gay rights activist, and they silenced him. So it's not uncommon that they'll silence people from left, right, center, whatever. There's just been a whitewashing and a romanticization of leftist criminality, political criminality. They think it's all justified because the ends justify the means, but the problem is the ends always become the means. I'm sorry, the means always become the ends.
Yeah, the wise person knows that the means create the ends, so yeah. they're not separate. Yeah, along with people not understanding such things, it makes me think about the book by John Taylor Gatto, Dumbing Us Down, the Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, where, you know, I think it was the mid-1800s where this book kind of starts being written from, the idea that, you know, getting away from homeschooling and getting away from the small, you know, round schoolroom where basically the idea is you had the state teach. So ultimately you're learning what the state wants you to learn. And so if the left owns education, well, I mean, one of the things that definitely helped that was compulsory public education.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's probably right. You know, it could be done differently, but it has been done the way it's been done. And that's true. I mean, and it has been the left that has led the charge for public education, compulsory public education, from the start, without a question.
Definitely. Okay, I'm going to pass the phone over to Aaron here.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the idea of language. Mm-hmm. I have a dictionary from the 1890s, and it's about the size of a cinder block. Huge, heavy, you can barely lift it up. Wow. And I look at how language has been constricted these days. You could almost have a snowflake dictionary that is the size of a People magazine, flimsy, hardly anything in there, with socially approved bits of soundbite language, memes, bumper stickers. It seems that it's been greatly diminished and debate has shut down. And I wanted to hear your comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a great deal of effort to curtail certain language, to force the certain expressions upon us, and to really, I would say, make our language. I mean, this is basically what George Orwell was talking about in his essay about the English language. They basically took the English language and they've totally bastardized it, and not just English, but generally language itself. And they have basically attempted to use, you know, I would say really caricatures or cartoonish versions of language, and also to impose different language on us, like, you know, these new words like cis, and, you know, the constant changing of the proper denotation for the proper way of referring, appellation for, you know, trans. It's been transsexual, it's been transgender, and it'll probably change again. The constant updating and imposition of pronouns upon us, you know, I can't even keep up with them. There's so many, but I ignore most of them. The zer and z and so on and so forth. This is a way of trying to control perceptions of reality, because language really, if you can make people believe that certain words actually have a referent, that there's some reality that they refer to, then you go a long way in producing that reality in people's minds. And that's what's going on. I hope that's clear enough.
That's why I thought the dictionary should be very thin, because there's so many words we can't use anymore. And there are these little socially approved terms that we can use. So that's why I use that contrast of an 1890s dictionary to something we would use today for snowflakes, you know, the snowflake language.
There's the expurgated version of the dictionary without a question. And there is this, there's definitely a demand to trim the language and to, you know, to really curtail it, but also to cultivate it towards a certain end. And that is the end of making certain realities appear real.
It also seems like a limited vocabulary limits one's ability to experience life, to actually see the world, ultimately to think, and then along with that, to express what they've experienced.
That's right. It's very true that if you curtail language and you start making certain statements, certain types of words verboten, you actually control people's ability to think. Because thinking, as most philosophers will tell you, is undertaken in language for the most part. That doesn't mean that reality is a construct of language itself, but that means that our own experience of thinking depends upon language. And if you can get rid of, if you have an expurgated, highly curtailed, abbreviated version of the dictionary or of acceptable words, acceptable parlance, then you go a long way into controlling people's thinking. Because you can't think certain thoughts without having the language to express it. At least you can't make it public what you think. And so, you know, regardless of the philosophical question about thought and whether it's purely language-based or not, if you can't express in language the thoughts that you're having, then this really goes a long way to diminishing their existence. And that's the kind of thing that's going on. I mean, I think Jordan Peterson pointed this out. Without language, you know, if you limit people's language use, you limit their ability to think. Absolutely.
That makes sense because, you know, reading, when you're reading something challenging, it's like a workout. It's like spending time on the treadmill, and you're expanding your ability to, well, you're expanding your vocabulary, you're also expanding your ability to experience. And so it's literally a workout. And without that effort to constantly improve one's vocabulary, to read challenging things, to read well-written things, we definitely are experiencing and expressing a phenomenal lesser experience of life.
Yeah, that's right. And it's true that, and the interesting thing is, well, this is a group of people that refuses binaries where gender is concerned. It's a very binary thinking people, so that you have no granular thoughts, no shades of anything, no subtleties. Everything is black and white, good or bad, good or evil. This is a very up or down, very black and white thinking culture, this SJW culture. And so they diminish the ability to think in terms that are more complicated and subtle and shaded, and actually they kind of cut off, you know. So it requires to have mass movements like this, to have people chanting in the street, you know, a slogan over and over and over. You've got to get rid of discriminating thought, right? Because that is a barrier to creating this kind of robotic left that's being constructed right now.
The chanting.
Hey, oh. Hey.
Yes.
Ho, ho, insert here. Has to go.
Right.
Yeah, that's bad because you're a Nazi.
That's right.
Well, along with language, like what you're saying, at this point, I feel like when I'm talking to somebody who I characterize as a snowflake, nothing can be complicated. If a topic comes up, if it's not a binary evil or benevolent like Che Guevara, nothing can be complicated. It seems like there's a real loss of
Nazi. Yeah, you used the word, I'm sorry to cut in, but you used the word Nazi, and that's interesting because I'm a classical liberal in effect. I believe in individual rights, individual expression, individuality, and individualism. And I've been called a Nazi by these people, even though that's the furthest thing from what I am, because Nazism is collectivism. It's more like the Antifa than it is me. Antifa is more like a Nazi than I am. They're a collectivist, mobbish mentality that's anti-individualistic, anti-human rights, individual rights, right? They don't care about your individual rights. So it's interesting to be called a Nazi by people that just don't know. They have such a very curtailed and abbreviated notion of the political spectrum, first of all. And historically, they're completely ignorant to call everybody that they disagree with a Nazi. It's a trivialization of what people who actually suffered under the Nazis experienced. And it's a very, very pathetic way of characterizing all of your all of your enemies. It's just so pathetically anti-intellectual and weak.
Your dad was actually, he was in World War II.
Right.
Yeah, and so he actually...
Yeah,
and so he fought against the Nazis, and so then somebody's calling you a Nazi. It's almost like not understanding that if you're alive today, you've had ancestors that tried to kill each other. You know,
that's correct.
It's this real lack of knowledge of history, or even you might say common sense, because like if one thing about language being so reduced. Having studied World War II history some, especially like German culture during World War II, you get into, well, if you're calling everybody a Nazi, the term is complicated. Mm-hmm. What exactly do you mean? Because ultimately, if we take it at a very high level, I mean, national socialism and a democratic socialist, could you really talk about what is the difference? Because to me, a national socialist is just socialism based on race, and mm-hmm. a democratic socialist is just a socialist.
Yeah.
So when they call you a Nazi, what exactly do they mean?
They don't know what they mean, and they don't know what it is, and they don't know the history of fascism. They don't know the history of Nazism. They don't know the connections, actually, that fascism grew out of socialism as a nationalist response to what they deemed to be the failure of Marxism, not a rejection of it. So all of this is very well, you know, well known, and but by people that read or know anything, but not by this people, because these people, all they do is, you know, they think that the whole history of the human race is, you know, that every evil deed that was ever done in the history of humanity was done by straight white males. They don't realize that every people that is alive today has been a colonist, has been an imperialist, has been a genocidal force of some sort here and there. They don't even realize that slavery still is going on today in Libya. After the deposing of Gaddafi, the conditions were set such that Islamists are now enslaving African males right now in Libya. They're auctioning them off, you know, so... They don't know any of this, so it's just astounding.
Mm, and a burqa is a symbol of freedom. Yeah.
Oh, yes. And Linda Sarsour is a representation of feminism, even though she loves Sharia law.
I wanted to touch on the Liberalist podcast. It was a great interview.
Oh,
you
thanks.
Mentioned the only, I may be quoting a little bit wrong, but I think you in general said that the only real minority is the individual.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
so, right.
And how could you expound on that a little bit? Because I really like that, basically.
I mean, so the only kind of rights that exist can be individual rights, because individuals are, in effect, a subject to others, to groups, okay? And so if you allow groups' rights and groups to run... everything. If you have mobocracy or ruled by the mob and you don't protect individual rights, then you don't have any rights, because they'll just rob the individuals within those groups and, of course, individuals in other groups of their rights. So the individual is the only real minority, because the individual is the one who is whose rights are the least protected or the most endangered, let's put it that way, the most endangered in any situation. And that's the real vulnerable the real vulnerable entity in society is always the individual. And this goes for people that are members of minorities as well as others. You know, Ralph Ellison, who was a great Harlem Renaissance writer, whose book Invisible Man I think is a masterpiece, basically suggested that the worst thing about racism was the denial of his individuality as a person. The other things are abhorrent as well. But the worst thing that he suffered was the erasure of his self and the inconsideration of him as a singular individual. And the idea that he represented some group as opposed to being himself first and foremost. So that's kind of what I'm getting at with the individual being the only true minority. It's the only really endangered entity in the social order, the ultimate endangered entity. And the thing that we need to protect, because without the protection of individuals, there's no protection of anyone. The only reason we respect groups is because there are individuals within those groups, right? The only reason why we've tried to promote the rights of groups is because there's individuals whose rights within those groups were abrogated at some point, right? So, for example, under slavery, we promote the rights of African Americans, not so that they can be a mob, but so they can be individuals with, and ultimately that it's individuals' rights that we're protecting, not some groups.
Yeah, well, I would love to go drill back down into the definition of a snowflake, and we could talk about the intricacies or lack thereof of being a snowflake, and also some of the factors aside from indoctrination that lead to the creation of a snowflake. For instance, social media, video gaming, or some of the helicopter parenting or parenting techniques these days.
Yeah, I think all those factors are all real. And you could say that the helicopter parenting, the notion of fragility that comes with, you know, this idea that everybody is traumatized or some trauma is always impending or, you know, already happened. All of this, I think, goes into procuring the raw material for a snowflake, but it requires a highly skilled craftsman to turn a snowflake into a snowflake, to turn a person into a snowflake. And this, I think, takes place in the university for the most part, where the snowflake and mentality is encouraged and is cultivated using ideology in particular to do so. And the kind of ideology I'm referring to is the ideology of victimization, and that one is precious and always at risk of being destroyed. That one is especially precious and unbelievably fragile entity that must be protected at all costs and is always a victim, right? So it's a victim mentality, really, when it comes down to. And they'll invent victimization if it doesn't exist. You know, so even what I'm saying, they will construe as victimization. Even my use of the word snowflake in the book title has been construed as victimization. I say that the only people that are insulted or hurt by the use of the word snowflake in my title are snowflakes. Because who else would be upset about that word? But they are upset, apparently. The left claims that it's an insulting thing that I've used that word to refer to them and blah, blah, blah. And my answer is always the same. Nobody but snowflakes are insulted by that or hurt by that word. So I think all those elements go into it. I don't know about gaming as much, but I think, you know, social media, certainly helicopter parenting, this kind of quaffed sort of protected status of in victims, you know, everybody seeking victim classhood is the main key, you know. So it's the oppression Olympics that really is underway. And so what that means is everybody is seeking a bottom status, because the more subordinated you are, the better off. Because when the social justice hierarchy is flipped on its head, you'll be at the top. That's the key to seeking the bottom. That's why the Social Justice Olympics always runs downhill.
Well, what about the lack of emotional control they seem to have? Also, childlike, they're also very violent. They're very hypocritical. Violence. And they're very robotic.
Robotic, violent, hypocritical.
Childlike, lack of emotional control.
Lacking self-control. I mean, you nailed it all. You know, you hit it right on the head. They're all of those things. And and the interesting thing is that they're likely privileged as well. So-called privileged, right? These are kids that probably come, or people that come from probably middle class or upper middle class backgrounds to begin with, and yet are seeking status of victim status relentlessly, because it's easier that way. It's much easier to be a victim and then to claim a victim status than to actually accomplish something. So, and you know, this idea of accomplishment is utterly anathema to them. The idea that you would put industry, and I don't mean, you know, mega industry, I mean personal industry, that you would put that first, that you would want to be known by what you do as opposed to who you quote unquote are, as if who you are is so meaningful. What about what you do in life, like what you actually execute, what you're able to perform, what you're able to accomplish? What is the matter? Why are people not willing to be known by that? Because it's easier to just be somebody, to have an identity. Identity comes before everything for these people. And it's the first and last word. You know, I am this way, and that's because of I am, you know, I am who I am. I know what I know because of who I am. You know, I can say what I say because of who I am, because of my special identity. None of this is about I can say what I say because I back it up with history or knowledge or, you know, so that none of those come into play. It always is underpinned by identity. And that identity is, of course, a victimized one. And so this leads to the lack of control, because you don't have people that are working to be anything, to accomplish anything. They're just relying on their identity status to get by.
It reminds me of Star Wars. Initially, when Joseph Campbell and George Lucas sat around and thought up the first Star Wars, that was the whole idea of the mask that Darth Vader wore and the Stormtroopers wore, was basically it was your identity. It was your corporate identity. You were an executive. Whatever role you were playing was this plastic face mask. And so ultimately, like in the end of the third movie, when Luke takes the mask off Darth Vader, there's this ultimately underdeveloped child. So underneath the identity, there's a very underdeveloped, there's basically a child that never grew up.
Yes. I think I'm glad you pointed out the difference between social identity and, you know, the real singularity of the person and their individual selfhood, because the latter is not developed, because they're hiding behind a social identity, a mask, as you put it. And that's exactly the problem, because the mask, it stands for everything. They don't need to be anybody to do anything, to accomplish anything. All they have to do is don this particular mask, this particular social identity, and that is supposedly sufficient for everything. And this is why they have so much what psychologists would call discontrol, because they don't have a discipline from work, from doing things, from actually establishing any kind of habits of being that require self-discipline and so forth. So this leads to the temper tantrums. The violence is part of this discontrol. If they see something they don't like, they think they have the right to try to destroy it rather than to deal with it and grapple with its reality in some other way, like either to argue with it or to understand it. None of that. All that requires work, and they don't have that ethic. I know that sounds very old-fashioned, but I don't know how else to put it.
Like the tendency towards violence that we see, that's really not being attached to reality. That's truly living in an echo chamber, because ultimately violence makes you a felon and can very well destroy your life. And we see a lot of that happening. And that's very unfortunate, because there's an underdeveloped child underneath that mask, like quite literally the mask that like the Antifa characters are wearing, because, you know, becoming a felon destroys your life. And I think a lot of them, they do not realize that when the cops grab you and you've assaulted somebody, you're a felon and your life to some extent is very much over. And it's unfortunate that they've been played. They don't know any better.
Well, I think they actually think that I think they're looking for this because once they're marked like this, it absolves them from other things. So that once you've ruined your life, you've done it for the cause, so you're a hero. And in their minds, they're martyrs, you see. They think themselves as heroic martyrs who have taken one for the team or for the cause. And therefore, they're now exempt from other types of activity. And so they don't have to become, you know, people. They don't have to become anyone who contributes anything to the world or even to themselves. They just, that's it, you know. They're done. They've done their duty. And I think they actually do it for that reason.
Yeah, it's like the same as getting likes on social media. You know, it's just unfortunate that they're, you know, children ultimately under the mask making adult mistakes. And that's why we need to grow up and not keep making that. Some things are forgiven of a child, but not of an adult.
Yes, but, you know, in their milieus, they're all forgiven, you know, and if they're taking over everything, before you know it, all of this will be forgiven because they're taking over the court system, you know, and that's because the law schools are becoming social justice law schools. They're even calling themselves that. And high schools are social justice high schools. We're having this thing is infiltrating everything. So it's hard to say. It's hard to say whether they'll really pay a price because of this, you know, this very latitudinarian attitude towards their petulance.
Why do you think they're giving so many microphones to idiots these days?
Well, because I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. They're giving microphones to idiots and idiots.
I could expound upon that a little bit. Let me actually expound upon that question where in Springtime for Snowflakes, page 115, you mentioned with the rise of social justice by the second term of the Obama administration, a transmutation in the polis began. The transmutation involved the personalization of the political. And I guess the idea is that I do see that during the second term of Obama, something happened where the mainstream media, who never were that great, but at that moment, it does seem that the narrative, like who you ask the question, who you had expert commentary from, etc., it's like the quality of that person just went downhill till eventually it seemed like the mainstream media would just find the most mentally incapable person to actually give commentary on anything.
Exactly.
Right.
And
that's right. That's true. And it's because it's producing the kind of discursive field that they want, really. If, you know, first of all, I think there's something to the idea of divide and conquer, put these idiots out there attacking other people. And you have, you know, this kind of warfare going on the ground, and whatever's going on above their heads is basically unknown. That's part of it. But I do think that, you know, the left has had a tremendous influence on everything, including education, all the ideological state apparatuses, including all the media, and of course, social media. And so these are ready mouthpieces for the left's propaganda. And they're being permitted and even, I should say, they're even being encouraged and institutionally supported to be idiots, and to instead of colleges and universities being places where people are encountering ideas and having intellectual discourse, they're chanting idiotic slogans ad infinitum. It's unbelievable. And this is what's counting as college now. So, you know, and as I pointed out in the book, you had a student at that applied to Stanford University in 2017, who wrote his main essay was a repetition of hashtag Black Lives Matter 100 times, and they admitted him. So that tells you that these universities actually want sloganeers like this.
Well, you're proving yourself to the party, basically. The only thing is you don't get any medals. You just get, you know.
You're proving yourself to the party. That's exactly right. You're proving yourself to the group itself, and as such, you're getting you're doing their bidding, and as you know, and also you're doing sort of you're putting up the. I'm going to be writing about this with a colleague soon, not a colleague, but a fellow academic, and we're going to write about why, in fact, the rhetoric on the left just keeps getting more and more incendiary with time, and there's some valuation that goes on. There's a limited, you know, amount of cultural capital there that they're competing for. So those who say the most outlandish thing get the capital. That's part of the answer. But we're going to have a full-fledged discussion of that phenomenon soon.
Looking forward to that.
Thank you.
Yeah, it does seem that the extreme left, you might say, like the, I'll just call it this democratic socialism, like the socialism seems to have gotten, it's almost like a monster that's gotten out of control, because it really is a fringe, I think. It's definitely not classical liberalism. It's definitely not, I think, what most, you might say, democratic voters in this country really believe in, but I think that has hijacked the party. It's kind of like if we look back at the George W. Bush years, I mean, definitely the neocons, the globalists, the warmongers they used the Republican Party during the Bush years, you could say. And then especially during the second term of Obama, ultimately now you've got the globalists using a party in a different way. It really just comes down to like who the empire is using switches parties at
That's
will.
Right. That's a very good way of putting it.
And I always thought it was very unfortunate where, for my more conservative friends, I always felt bad that George W. Bush and the neocons were just destroying the Republican Party. Anybody who just basically believes in, how about the Constitution and less taxes? Then you have your, you know, like maybe your classical liberals who are kind of now getting really destroyed by the extreme left that I think originally was a tool used to, you know, gain favor, to gain votes, but this is a monster that got out of its cage. Do you think that it is a monster gotten out of its cage, and can it ever get reeled back in, or do people just know too much now? I mean,
that's a really good, what you've just said is very interesting, and I think that's one of the reasons why people, you know, are shocked by my transition, because I was a leftist when, you know, Bush was in office, and now I see how the left is being used by the same powers that be that use the right to undertake their, you know, whatever they were interested in doing. And what they're interested in doing now, I think, is globalism, of course. And therefore, they want to level the wages across the world. And I think that's part of the reason why they're fostering multiculturalism and making it illegal to even criticize certain, you know, Islam, for example, in Britain and things like that. So, and that's probably coming here soon. It's already in Canada as well. But I think that's a very good explanation for this.
Yeah, our friends who are from Europe are oftentimes telling us about how they literally will go to jail if they say certain things. And then people that we know who are originally from Europe who want to go back and travel and visit family say, well, I'm not sure, you know, I've tweeted a few things and I know you got to get going. We want to wrap things up.
Yeah.
So where can people get a hold of you? What's coming up? You know, I guess, how would you wrap this up?
I mean, I think that first of all, you can get a hold of me by, you know, checking out my Twitter handle, AntiPCNYUProf. You can reach me at, you can go to the website springtimeforsnowflakes.com for the book and also other writings by me on this topic and other topics. But there's a whole slew of other information. All my interviews are basically kept there, all the links to those. So to keep on top of what I'm doing, just go to springtimeforsnowflakes.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
It was great.
It's my pleasure for being here. Thank you so much for having me.